So this week I interviewed Errol Lewis, and he is a journalist and local news figure, and I've been watching him for a while, and I really wanted to interview him because I was talking a lot about local politics at the time, and it was right around the time of New York's a major election, and now with the recall election of Gavin Newsom, it's definitely still relevant. All of this episode is super relevant, but I think definitely the recall election with Gavin Newsom illustrates one of the things we talked about, which is how local politics can influence federal politics, even though, Gavin Newsom, the governor, is still not very local, but still. And I think this episode is just a really good conversation about a lot of different aspects of journalism, civic engagement. This episode is a little bit shorter than normal, but I hope everyone still enjoys.
All right. So, what do you think makes a good interview?
Wow. Well, a good interview should be the kind of conversation that somebody wants to eavesdrop or listen in on. So you want it to be kind of natural with the sort of a back and forth, but you also want it to be what you call expositional, meaning that there's information that people are learning that they come away with some kind of what I would call a payoff, meaning they come away from it saying, gee, I didn't know that before. Or wow, that's really important. I'm glad I listened to that. Or boy, that's a really interesting person. I'm really, intrigued by what they had to say. There should be some kind of a payoff. That's what makes it worth broadcasting. That's what makes it worth listening to. And it's harder than it looks. You want it to feel like it's just a conversation, like somebody just kind of, bumped into you on the street or at a dinner party or something. But the reality is, to make it feel that way takes a fair amount of research and practice and other kind of work, which is where people like me come into the picture. But generally, it should feel very natural, very unforced, and very interesting.
Do you have a favorite interview you've ever done?
Oh boy. That's a great question. there are individuals that I was glad to speak with. And I'd say I'd merge all of the ones together that I've done with Ken Burns, the documentary filmmaker. I've interviewed him maybe half a dozen times. I've also spoken to him for my podcast. Just a really interesting guy and always has something in his back pocket out of a history book. to pull out and reframe or add context to a conversation. I always really, really enjoy that. The other interviews that I've really enjoyed have been with my friend Cindy Adams, who's a columnist for the New York Post, who's just funny as hell. She's just a great person, a real New York character, and kind of challenges almost every preconception that you can imagine. She's always got something really fun and witty to say. She seems to know everybody in the city. And, she really manages in an interview, sitting in a TV studio, to reproduce what it's like to hang out with her and have drinks over dinner or at her home, which I have also done. It's pretty much the same. She's just a great personality and a great person to interview. So those two, I guess, would be in my top five.
Yeah, it's interesting because both of the people you mentioned are not politicians. So how do you like approach politicians and non-politicians differently?
Oh, that's an interesting, it's an interesting point. I hadn't really thought about that. It's all really pretty much the same. I mean, with some of the public figures, the political leaders, there's usually an agenda. And so there's usually some set of questions that I have to ask them about the story at hand, about an election, about a public policy, about a law that they passed or would like to see passed, something like that. It's a little different with some of the cultural figures. You want to talk to them about their book or their movie or whatever it is that they're trying to promote. And it gives you, I guess, a lot more angles to get into the human condition or their philosophy on life or, much broader kinds of questions. With the politicians, you really do have to make sure you've got your ducks in a row and you've done your research, because they're usually coming in on business, so to speak, meaning they're trying to accomplish something very specific. And a lot of it is actually very, very important, as we discovered during the pandemic. You want to make sure you're accurately conveying a lot of information in what is ultimately a rather brief amount of time.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. It kind of goes to another question I had, which is, how do you try to include like different voices in your interviews in your journalistic life?
Well, I mean, a good interview, the preparation for a good interview should include lots of different angles, you know, playing the devil's advocate, as they describe it, giving different perspectives, making sure you can add as many as possible, you know, the kind of formulation where you say, well, your critics would say X, Y, and Z, what would you say to that? In other words, you sort of conduct almost a kind of a debate, ask them to explain themselves and sort of probe the barriers or the outer limits or the implications of whatever argument it is that they are trying to make. I went to law school, and so that is part of what they teach you about trial technique and about evidence and discovery and legal argumentation comes in very handy. It's the same general idea. If somebody says, you know, we need to defund the NYPD. Okay, well, there's the five W's. Who, what, when, where, why? Well, you know, why? How much? When would you do it? How would you do it? What would be the implications of that? The critics say that it would lead to more crime in the streets, that it would do this, that it would do that. And you really just kind of structure it, and you just kind of walk through it in a way that a third person listening in would be able to follow the thread of the argument. That's really kind of what the whole art of an interview is you just kind of walk them down the logical path of whatever the subject is.
Yeah. Do you think that mass media and national media have hurt, you know, this idea of bringing in different voices because of how polarized it's become?
I mean, look, bringing in different voices is always a choice. And, you know, for commercial media, there's a certain amount of money that you can make, and it is a vast amount of money, by simply polarizing people and creating a big fancy echo chamber in which outside ideas are only brought in to be ritually ridiculed and dismissed or ignored. It's not a great way to build an audience or keep an audience in the long run. But you can, in the short run, and the short run could mean, you know, 5 years, 10 years, you can make a ton of money doing that, giving people what they want and, you know, scratching their back in the place where they like it scratched, over and over and over and over. You know, I don't do that. I try not to do that. I don't like that. I think it's boring. I don't watch it. The shows like a show like, say, 60 Minutes, which is very, very successful, they don't do that. They take the long view. That's why they've been on the air for, you know, 60 years or whatever the amount is now. And it's because ultimately, people do want variety, and they do want different opinions. And if my competitor in the news business doesn't want to provide it, then I will, and I will reap the benefits of it. And I think that's, you know, the kind of natural competition that should be leading more organizations away from polarization. It can't happen soon enough, and it's not happening fast enough for my taste, but I think ultimately that's where things are going to settle out.
How do you think we'll get to that point of, like, being less polarized?
Well, look, a lot of it has to do with the audience. A lot of it has to do with, you know, people like you, that, you know, people who want to broadcast and tell other people, there's another way to do this. We don't have to have a bunch of angry echo chambers where people scream and rage about invisible others, you know, and characterize them and demonize them. That it's not only bad for politics, but it's just not terribly interesting.
Right.
And so ultimately, I think the only way to do it, and this is what I spend a fair chunk of my life doing, is to just fight it out, build a bigger audience, win better awards, You know, I teach journalism. I have for more than 10 years now. I populate the newsrooms with people who have been exposed to the way that I like to do journalism. And I'm trying to teach others to do a similar level of work. And in the end, we will win.
Yeah. This is a little bit of a pivot, but I always find that there's a lot of people who know a lot about national politics, and they can tell you all about the different presidential candidates, but they don't really know a lot about like local politics. So do you see a divide between how people, like, do you see a divide in cities of people knowing a lot about politics on a national level and not on a local level?
Well, there's much less of a difference than I think most people in think, you know, especially in New York. I mean, you know, it might be different if you're talking about Des Moines, Iowa, or something like that in a non-presidential year. For New York, you know, we got the United Nations here. You know, I mean, we've got, you know, in 2016, we had a debate in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. I was one of the questioners in the debate. And it was Bernie Sanders, who was born in Brooklyn, versus Hillary Clinton, who represented New York in the U.S. Senate. And then ultimately in the general election, it was two New Yorkers who both had their headquarters in New York City. You know, it was Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton. So, I mean, that was as graphic an example as you can imagine of there being really no distinction between national and local politics. And that was an extreme example, but that tends to be true all of the time, really. I mean, it really does. It's not, I mean, it's just not, almost everybody you see in politics at the national level started out locally, right? I mean, I met Chuck Schumer when he was a congressman representing Brooklyn, a section of Brooklyn. And now he's the Senate Majority Leader dealing with international and national affairs. It happens quicker than you would think. And it happens all the time. So if you consider that almost without exception, maybe one or two exceptions, every member of the U.S. Senate started out as a local official somewhere. All news is local. All of their concerns are local. You know, you can't really understand Joe Biden without understanding Scranton, Pennsylvania, and the politics of Delaware, and on down the line. So, you know, people who think that they're hooked into national politics, but they can't be bothered with local politics, their understanding is going to be flawed. And if they're a news professional, there's going to be somebody like me who's going to come behind them and eat their lunch and supply all of the context and the background that they were a little too lazy to try and figure out.
Yeah. And then also, I know you mentioned Iowa. So how do you think local politics and politics in general differs in cities versus in suburbs?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. In fact, I grew up in the suburbs. I grew up in New Rochelle. And once in a while, I even had somebody on the show. There's a suburban institute that's affiliated, I think, with Hofstra University. It's metropolitan New York. If you're talking about the New York suburbs, I mean, I grew up steeped in New York politics. I knew a lot more about the politics of New York City than about the politics of New Rochelle because of the nature of the media and because almost everybody was tied into the city by the economy. It's where everybody's parents work. It's where all of the culture and everything else was. So it's not, frankly, it's not that much different. You know, once in a while, in a sort of a technical sense, there are certain questions that are not just city questions. Like if you're talking about the MTA, you're talking about regional transportation, that sort of a thing. But other than that, it's all kind of one big story.
Yeah. Do you think the suburbs do a better job of engaging in politics and like local politics especially?
No, I think in the suburbs, they are getting away with murder because there's not nearly as much attention paid to what they're doing in Westchester County. You know, I mean, I couldn't name you who's in charge of the Westchester County legislature. And they are making laws, including tax policy, for, you know, one of the richest suburbs in the whole United States, where they got billionaires and stuff, you know? I mean, it's real serious stuff. There are stinky deals and contracts and all kinds of chicanery that goes on, believe me, in every suburb in around New York. And we just don't have enough people and enough news organizations to give it the level of attention that it deserves, to make sure these folks are not stealing everything in sight. It's a great frustration. You know, we don't have quite enough of a news presence to cover the city the way we should. And it's 1,000 times worse out in the suburbs, where, like I said, they're getting away with murder. Even as we speak, there's somebody doing something that probably deserves to be exposed. And I'm not sure there's a reporter there who's going to track them down and bring it to light.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm interested in hearing, like, I feel like a lot of journalism is civic engagement. So do you have a definition of civic engagement?
Well, I mean, I think of it as one and the same. You know, there are these phrases that come along once in a while. They'll say, we're going to do civic engagement journalism, or we're going to do solutions journalism. That was popular a few years ago. We're going to do social journalism that's, you know, driven by social engagement. And to me, it's all the same. You know, I mean, they're all euphemisms for what the job is. When I started in journalism, I was using a manual typewriter. The mini computer, the desktop computer, had not been invented. The cell phone had not been invented. So all of these great fancy tools, in many ways, end up flooding us with more information and not necessarily more wisdom or more knowledge. I think the whole idea of journalism, going all the way back to the beginning, and it has never changed, is you want to make sure that you're telling your audience what it is they need to know about things that are important and relevant and interesting and occasionally fun. If you're not doing that, there's a real question as to, you know, what you are doing with your publication. Doing the kind of service that's usually called civic engagement, reminding people to vote, telling people what their duties are with, say, jury duty, telling people in an emergency what's going on with something like the pandemic, that's basic. That is like 101. That's the reason this whole thing exists. It's why we have a First Amendment. It's been true since the beginning of the country. Anybody who's not doing that, again, I would just say they have to ask themselves, well, you know, if you're not doing that, what are you doing?
That's interesting, because I feel like the way I see it, if journalism is a form of civic engagement and being a politician is a form of civic engagement, do you think there's a comparison to be made between the two? Because I feel like so many people put them at odds with one another, but maybe, yeah.
Well, they are. I mean, look, in the world of checks and balances, which I'm sure you have read about and been tested on, the press plays a critical role. There's only one profession that is mentioned specifically in the U.S. Constitution, and that's journalism. And it's protected specifically by the Constitution. So it's woven into the fabric of the government. If you go down, I think they're going to open it up soon, but if you get a chance to go down to City Hall and go into the City Council chamber, there's a section of it that's reserved for the press. If you ever go down to the U.S. Supreme Court, even if there's a line stretching around the corner of people who want to get into the very small gallery, public gallery, to hear arguments in a Supreme Court case, there's always space there for the press. And there's a reason for that. The reason is that it is part and parcel of how we vindicate our constitutional rights and obligations. It's a very high calling and a very important responsibility. And despite people who, disdain or denigrate the profession, I think it's really important. And I wake up every day feeling lucky that I could be a part of it.
I think that's a great place to end right there.
Okay.
Thank you so much. This has been awesome.
Oh, no, you've done a great job. And if you are actually interested in journalism, I can tell you what it looks like from college on up. I would say that you are well on your way. If this didn't feel like a lot of work, imagine doing this every day, all the time. You know, I mean, when my wife talks to me about retiring, I always answer the same way. I say, well, retire from what? Yeah. I've been doing this since I was 19 and I'm still having fun.
That's when you know you found the right thing.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it again.